This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because these microphones create a Main Street all across our state this time of day. The real Main Streets are places where we're hunkered down today, trying to get across the street, maybe into a warm spot, to talk about what's on our mind, share our news and opinions, you know, this and that. And today is an important day in American history and in remembrance of things past related to that. This is Martin Luther King Jr. Day across the country. This is a federal holiday that was established in 1983 in North Dakota. It was recognized officially by the state in 1991. And we're going to talk about Martin Luther King Jr., his legacy, the civil rights movement, the status of racial relations with Dr. Peter Huff. He is the director of the St. John Paul II Center for the University Ministry and a professor of theology at the University of Mary. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I should mention that a featured speaker, Albert J. Robitaille, an author of wonderful books about the issue of racial relations in the United States and religion, was going to be a featured speaker at a special event this evening in Bismarck. He's under the weather and won't be able to make it, but Dr. Huff will be talking about Martin Luther King Jr. So let's talk about the significance of Martin Luther King Day to you.
Well, this is something that's very personal to me. I grew up in Atlanta, and I'm old enough to have seen King on TV during his lifetime. Unfortunately, I never met him or saw him in person. But for 10 years, I was able to observe him on TV and, of course, hear my parents and other elders talking about him in Atlanta. And growing up in the Baptist church myself, I was able to also feel a certain kinship with him since he was a Baptist minister. And so to see the evolution of this day is really something that gives me great pride. And I see it also as, of course, as a professor, I see it as a great teachable moment every year.
Well, what do you hope you, Mary students, and for that matter, the Bismarck-Mandan community members experience at this evening's celebration?
Well, King is such a multifaceted person, and of course, the movement that he was involved in has all sorts of dimensions to it. Every year that goes on, we lose, of course, actors from that movement, so we lose the personalities one by one. And I believe we lose some of that personal connection, so it becomes more and more foreign, unfortunately, to younger students. So I always try to help them understand King in depth and try to give them some depth into the movement itself. But it's crucial that we not lose contact with the struggles of the civil rights movement.
Well, as important as Martin Luther King Jr. was to people at large before he was assassinated, murdered in 1968, he was considered a radical by a lot of people at that time. And Christianity was a radical movement when it got underway. Is that lost on most modern Christians, do you think?
Unfortunately, I think so. And, you know, this is something that King tried to keep in the forefront of his message. We forget that he was an ordained minister, a Baptist minister, and, you know, we refer to him as Dr. King, but I don't know if people could tell you what his doctorate was in. It was in theology. Mm-hmm. So here we have a theologian who is taking his theology to the streets, to the social marketplace, and he is reminding us page after page, word after word in his speeches and sermons that, yes, there's a radical dimension to Christianity from the beginning, and he's trying to recover that.
Well, let's talk about the role of the church in advancing change. Give us your perspective on that.
Well, in the civil rights movement, the black churches were the crucial institution. They were the crucial element in the whole mix. And that's probably a phenomenon that we could not recreate today. We have to remember that in the South, during segregation, if you were a leader in the black community, you were probably a minister. Very few in any sort of political role, some in business, a few in media in a segregated system, a few teachers here or there, but it was truly the clergy who had the leadership role. And so the churches were the meeting places, The songs of the movement came from the spirituals of the slavery period and struggles beyond that. And it's truly the ministers like King and all of his associates that were taking the leadership roles. So without the church and the network of churches throughout the South and the rest of the nation, I don't see if we could have had the civil rights movement the way it took place in the 50s and 60s.
I think a lot of your students probably don't fully understand how dangerous it was to be outspoken about civil rights in the Deep South during this time period we're talking about.
Oh, yes. When you talk about the movement itself, then you start to go through the list of the martyrs and the victims. And, of course, King is the great example of the price that would be paid when you step out and you begin to expose the racism that's at the heart of the system, and you begin to lose allies as you intensify your critique.
Dr. Robitaux, who is, again, ill and will not be speaking this evening, has written books, and one of those books was American Prophets. And he calls Martin Luther King Jr. a prophet.
Right. That's Robitaux's most recent book. And it's really a great product of a long career of Robitaux's reflection on the full African-American experience and the broader radical tradition, as he puts it. And he puts King definitely in that tradition. And that is a perspective that takes faith and says we're going to apply the insights of faith to the social system and see the flaws, see the limitations, see what religious people would call a sin deeply embedded in the system. And King, I think, is one of the great figures in that tradition. Robitaux also mentions Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, Dorothy Day, Fannie Lou Hamer, Thomas Merton. So it's this small circle of Jews, Catholics, Protestants who were able to draw upon the insights of their faith and see the social system for what it was.
Well, racism is sort of an undercurrent that's always there, and sometimes it really pops up, and it did last week. The president said some things that have been widely reported and have been interpreted as racist by some people, including Congressman Elijah Cummings, a Democrat from Maryland who would know well. He was beaten almost to death during one of those protests a long time ago. He says President Trump is a racist. How do you react to that?
Well, I think we have a climate of social discourse now where we're no longer examining our own assumptions, our presuppositions. We're not examining the privilege that many of us who would be Euro-Americans gain from the racist strategies and structures of the past. And unfortunately, some in leadership seem to be blind to the struggles that have taken place in the past and seem to simply ignore the price of such language.
When I go online and I go to Facebook, I see many examples of overt racism. And there has been a blizzard of posts about refugees and the places they leave to come to America. Is this evidence that we are regressing?
Well, regress is possible. You know, we don't want to think that progress is somehow inevitable, that the price that was paid in the generation that King was in is precious. And we always want to guard that and realize that this is an ongoing process of trying to increase equality and opportunity, trying to keep justice in the forefront of our minds. So regress is certainly possible and is something that many of us fear.
When someone says, "I am not a racist," how do you react?
Well, I've been there. I know what it's like to profit from an unjust system. And it may be simply a matter of not knowing the full definition of racism or racist. It doesn't mean necessarily that we are consumed with hatred for people who are different from us, but it may be that we're comfortable in a system where others are experiencing exploitation or oppression, and we may not fully understand that we profit and gain comfort and stability from that unjust system. So, you know, in a classroom, you can, in a rational way, begin to explore these terms. In public discourse and personal relationships, it's much more difficult. But raising consciousness is what it's all about.
Well, what you just described is a good description of what is called institutional racism. But what is behind racial hatred?
It's learned behavior. I mean, that's really the sad thing. It seems like all studies of racism seem to suggest that we have to be trained to be racists. And I had to shed the implicit racism, at least, that I gained from my own childhood. And it's a lifelong process. So I don't think any person is born with an affinity for white supremacy. But we can certainly learn those lessons. And class is involved, too. And King was especially attuned to this. He realized that poor whites in the South were racist, probably because they were getting the short end of the economic and political stick. And so they were looking for someone to blame. And, of course, we've seen that sort of phenomenon in other countries as well. And, you know, the natural analog is the way Jews were treated in Nazi Germany.
Yes. Can you teach someone not to be a racist?
I think so. You know, if you define education in the broadest possible way of raising awareness, of inviting a person to do some real serious internal self-scrutiny, yes. But you know, the person always has to be willing to explore, you know, those shadowy sides of the internal life. And, you know, as someone who has done that personally, I think it is possible. And, you know, I can see that happening one by one. The problem is, as you mentioned before, there is this phenomenon of institutional racism, and that's much harder to examine and expose and then dismantle.
We tend to look at the past with rose-colored glasses, and, you know, we've been hearkening, I think, in this country recently to some mythical America where things were somehow better than today, and that we should go back to make our country, for example, to use a phrase out there, great again.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great country. And still,
yes.
So I don't think you and I are going to debate that. But why should we be looking back at something like this as opposed to just moving forward?
Well, I'm a historian by instinct.
There you go.
religious history is what I do. So explaining that to someone who doesn't share those instincts, you know, that's been one of the difficult parts of my personal life for many, many years. How do you get someone interested in the past? But for me, it's a matter of looking at these fascinating characters, these fascinating actors on the social stage who are so complex, whose motivations go so deep. And in the case of someone like King, who is willing to pay such a dear price, then I say, you know, that's the sort of greatness in our past that we never want to lose.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if we want to somehow return to another decade, another century. That doesn't make sense. And, of course, it's not even possible anyway. But to recover the greatness that we find in these particular individuals, that's a process of, you know, simply keeping our heritage alive, keeping the legacy of someone like King alive.
There will be a Martin Luther King celebration this evening at 7 at Trinity Lutheran Church in Bismarck. It's put on by the Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday Commission, which was established by Governor George Sinner in 1985. You will be speaking, Dr. Peter Huff, and there will also perhaps be in attendance some people who took part in a Luther League convention in Miami Beach where Martin Luther King Jr. spoke in 1961.
Yes, this is a wonderful opportunity to meet some individuals who were part of that. They went as teenagers and took the long train ride from North Dakota and other upper Midwestern states to Florida. We've been examining the artifacts from that experience in our meetings with the commission the last few weeks. And there were a fascinating roster of speakers and choirs and other events. And, of course, a young Dr. Martin Luther King speaking at the event as well. I think probably the participants realized that he was just a phenomenal character in that mix. And now I think he's the person that they most remember.
A man for the ages. Martin
yes.
Luther King Jr.'s celebration this evening at 7 at Trinity Lutheran in Bismarck. It is free and open to the public. Dr. Peter Huff from the University of Mary, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Coming up next on Main Street, a profile of Georgia Gilmore, a cook who secretly fed and funded the civil rights movement.
University of Mary in Bismarck presents the 45th Annual Jazz Festival Concert, Saturday, January 27th at 4 p.m. in Founders Hall in the new Lumen Vitae University Center. The concert features UMary Jazz Ensemble and vocal jazz with nationally renowned artists. Helen Song on piano, Steve Davis on trombone, Corey Christensen guitar, Josh Johnson on saxophone, and the vocal jazz quartet True North. Tickets are available online at umary.edu/jazz at Eckroth Music and at the door. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. NPR's Hidden Kitchen series tells the stories of local visionaries and food traditions with kitchen sisters Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. Today we'll share a story that takes us to Montgomery, Alabama. A listener from Oxford, Mississippi, John T. Edge, who heads the Southern Foodways Alliance, urged the series producers to look into the story of Georgia Gilmore, a cook in the 1950s in Montgomery who had a secret kitchen that fueled the civil rights movement.
Hey, how you doing? You live on the street. Do you know where Miss Gilmore used to stay?
Yeah, Miss Georgia Gilmore. That's Miss Gilmore house down there. You see that marker down there, that historical marker?
Oh, yeah, I see it now. You see the plaque in the yard?
Georgia Teresa Gilmore. I'm her son, Councilman Mark Gilmore, Jr.
Georgia Gilmore.
She could cook.
1920, 1990.
She was a stone cook.
Her food was cooked on the mama level. And Georgia was like Big Mama, Southern type mamas, maybe 10 or 15 of them.
Now, my mother at the time was a midwife by profession. She cooked at National Lunch Company in Montgomery when the movement started. When Mrs. Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to give up her seat in 1955, Mama got involved in the bus boycott.
She lost her job because management learned of her being a part of this movement that was going on. My name is Johnny Rebecca Carr, and I am the fifth president of the Montgomery Improvement Association.
Stop that Alabama bus. I don't want to ride.
During the bus boycott, City of Montgomery brought suit against King and 90 other members of the Montgomery Improvement Association in March of 1956. They were claiming that the bus boycott was an unlawful conspiracy. Georgia Gilmore testified in court. She, in essence, called out this bus driver who had kicked her off a bus. When Ms. Gilmore stood up in court, she got fired.
You cannot be afraid if you want to accomplish anything. You got to have the will and the spirit, and above all, you got to have the get up.
Everybody could tell you Georgia Gilmore didn't take no junk. I'm Reverend Al Dixon. If you pushed her too far, she'd say a few bad words, and if you pushed her any further, she would, she'd hit you.
She was swift on her feet. She could move. Mama weighed about 350, 400 pounds. Martin Luther King would call her tiny. God
is a pound of lax. She lived about three blocks from where Reverend King was living at the time. I'm a Nelson Malden. Reverend King, when he came to Montgomery, I was his first barber. Whenever VIPs would come to town, he would always have Miss Gilmore to cook up a batch of chicken. When she was fired from a restaurant, Reverend King said, well, why don't you go in business for yourself?
She turned part of her home into a dining area. Dr. King and the organization helped her to set up where she could go into business cooking in her own home.
Dr. Martin Luther King, he needed a place where he could go, where he could not only trust the people around him, but trust the food.
Plus, they had a lot of secret meetings, and they didn't want nobody to know, so they went to Georgia House. My name is Martha Hawkins at Martha's Place Restaurant. She inspired me to be able to do what I'm doing.
I'm Pastor Thomas E. Jordan, Little Baptist Church, Montgomery, Alabama. About 12 o'clock, we'd make a beeline to Georgia Gilmore's place. A lot of times, you have to wait in line to be fed.
Why don't you sit down? I can't sit down.
And as these would leave, another set would come, just like a Methodist communion table.
I'm Althea Thomas. I'm organist here at Dexter Avenue, King Memorial Baptist Church.
Sometimes there would be about four professors, clerical workers, a policeman or two.
Lawyers and doctors, black and white. People like Mars Dees with the Southern Poverty Law Center.
She could talk on everybody's level, a confidant. Know what's going down, know what's up.
Kennedy came, Johnson's been here, Dr. King brought him. Wallace. All of them had a chance to eat at my mother's table. She called you little names, you know. Come here, little heifer.
She'd be cooking that chicken. Sometimes she'd take it right out the grease and put it on your plate. You just eat wherever you could find a seat, stand up and eat whatever.
I say, come here, black woman.
Pork chops, stuffed bell peppers. She would have chitlins with slaw, and then take the hog maw and cut up in them. She could cook it, man.
The bus boycott lasted for 381 days. Georgia Gilmore, another phase of her work was that she had a group called the Club from Nowhere. She just made it up in her mind to start raising money for the movement.
Aren't you hungry? Well, why not buy a pie from the ladies of the boycott?
They sold pies and cakes in the beauty shops. A lot of them was afraid to let people know who they was, so they called themselves the Club from Nowhere.
They bought the station wagons for different churches. That's how they organized transportation. In every mass meeting, Dr. King would preach, and she would turn that money in. She raised more money than anybody there.
Georgia Gilmore died on a Friday, on the 25th anniversary of the Civil Rights Selma to Montgomery March. She was fixing food for the marchers, and at the visitation, her family served it to the mourners.
She cooked that morning a tub of macaroni and cheese, and she would have fixed a tub of chicken. She was getting ready to cook heavy to help feed the people, and she died.
Well, I think Georgia Teresa Gilmore was one of the unsung heroines of the civil rights movement. You know, Martin Luther King often talked about the ground crew. She was not really recognized for who she was. But had it not been for people like Georgia Gilmore, Martin Luther King Jr. wouldn't have been who he was.
That was from NPR's Hidden Kitchen series. The Georgia Gilmore story first aired in 2005. You can find out more about the series at kitchensisters.org. Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with author Roseanne Ederson Junker about her new book, Renata's Kayak, and a painful love story that it tells. But first, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Frigid and blustery, that's how officials with North Dakota's two National Weather Service offices are describing today.
It's a beautiful sunny day, clear, and can't really see much of the wind rustling the trees. But then you look over at the display and you see negative 8 degrees Fahrenheit and 14 knot winds gusting to 21 knots, which is about 23 to 24 miles per hour. So when you add those two factors together, it's not quite what it looks like outside.
Zach Hargrove is with the Bismarck office. He says the wind is cutting into visibility in some rural areas of western and central North Dakota. Hargrove says some relief is on its way, but we're going to have to endure some bitter cold before it arrives.
We are looking at another night where wind chills across the whole state, you know, could be approaching negative 35 to negative 40, maybe even negative 45.
After seeing as much as 2.5 inches of snow over the weekend, listeners in the eastern third of North Dakota are missing out on the sunshine being seen by the rest of the state. Here's meteorologist Nick Carletta.
We've had some pretty significant winds blowing through the area, driving all that snow, the relatively light snow that we got yesterday and some of the snow from before as well, through the air, causing some really low visibilities, particularly within the Red River Valley.
Carletta says the winds are expected to die down this evening, with temperatures remaining in the deep freeze range. Carletta and Hargrove say we can all look forward to some thawing weather by midweek. A member of the North Dakota Public Service Commission says while she's glad One Oak is planning to build a new natural gas liquids pipeline to carry Bakken NGLs, she's a little concerned that there may not be a supply for any potential petrochemical industry development in North Dakota. One Oak is planning to build the 900-mile Elk Creek pipeline from eastern Montana to Kansas. Here's Commissioner Julie Fedorchak.
When these pipes go in, they get long-term commitments, and all of them, all of those NGLs then go in that pipe and go down to wherever that final destination is, off in Texas. And then it's really hard for anyone who wants to build a facility in North Dakota to actually have the ethane to do it.
Fedorchak says she appreciates One Oak's commitment, but she says she hopes there isn't a point of no return for any NGLs to be available for North Dakota. And some Jamestown businesses are fighting to keep exit 257 off I-94 open. The North Dakota Department of Transportation recently held an open house to gauge interest in proposed projects in the area. One of those is closing exit 257. Jason Babcock is owner of Neighborhood Grocery and Gas.
It'd be pretty difficult to see all that traffic that comes off the interstate and tries to get on the interstate from that direction to go away.
Neighborhood Grocery and Gas is one of several businesses along that stretch of roadway. Babcock says it's not only area residents that use exit 257 and 17th Street Southwest.
There's hundreds of vehicles that use it, along with emergency management, highway patrol, fire department, things like that. Anything that happens out west of town, that's the route they use to get out there fast.
Exit 257 is one of only 5 left-lane exits on interstates in North Dakota. The DOT has expressed concerns over these exits due to the slowdowns and speeds of the interstates. The city of Jamestown has planned a special meeting on Tuesday to collect comments and concerns, which will then be submitted to NDDOT. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
The 21st Annual Celebration of Women and Their Music will be held Saturday, January 20th at the stage at Island Park, featuring Brenda Wyler, Rosie Savageau-Nestingen, Laura Jossend, Emily Holt, Haley E. Rydell, and many more. Tickets available at 21stcelebrationofwomen.eventbrite.com. For complete information on all 3 days of events, go to debjenkins.com/celebrationofwomen.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Roseanne Innerson-Junker. She is the author of Renatus' Kayak, A Labrador Inuk, An American GI, and A Secret World War II Weather Station. And we're going to talk about why this is all should be interesting to our listeners with Roseanne. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Doug. I'm really happy to be here. I mean, it is a North Dakota story, hard as that is to believe.
Yes, you're a Hamilton, North Dakota native.
yes, which is why I looked you up.
And your uncle, who's central to the story, was from near Turtle Lake, right?
Yes, he was near Turtle Lake, born in Turtle Lake, and wasn't expected to live, was put in the oven anyway after he was born, and he lived until he was 88 years old.
All right. Well, why did you write the book? Was it to help your uncle?
Well, actually, I started to explore the whole issue of Labrador and the secret American weather station when he told me about serving in Hebron, Labrador during World War II. And Hebron, Labrador is on the east coast of Canada, and it's not too far from the North Pole. And he was there with six other Americans, at, as I said, at the secret weather station. And he started telling me about it. And I had just been to Hebron a year earlier, and nobody, none of the historians or archaeologists on the trip had said anything about the Americans being there. And so I contacted them, and I said, you know, my uncle says he served up there during the war. And they said, oh, no, you must be mistaken. And I said, oh, no, Woody has photographs, which he did. And not only photographs, he has this meter-long or yard-long sealskin kayak that was made by a man named Renatus Tuggalavina. And so I began the search for Renatus and his family.
So this is Woody Belsheim, your uncle.
Yes.
And this is well after World War II when you actually start talking to him about this.
65 years later, he had kept this kayak hanging in his bathroom, and it was in actually very good condition.
And here's this North Dakota boy working in Hebron, Labrador during World War II with a secret weather station. He would seem to be one of those people who would be acclimated to that particular part of the world.
Well, that's what he said. He said that the cold in Labrador never got to him because there was enough cold in North Dakota. But he said the winds in Labrador got to him, and the winds would get up to 155 miles an hour. And so they would have to shut down. When they got up to 75 miles an hour, they'd have to shut down their gas stoves and just go to bed and wait it out.
So is this like a Hudson's Bay place? Is this indigenous people's place?
Yes.
Whaling and that kind of stuff?
Yes, yes. Hebron means place of seals in the Inuktitut language. And the Inuktitut name for it means place of seals. And for thousands of years, Inuit have been living there. Moravian missionaries arrived in 1830. The Hudson's Bay Company actually didn't take over the trading post there until 1926, and they stayed until 1942. But it's the kind of place the Hudson's Bay Company would be, and the Newfoundland Rangers. You know, it's all of these institutions, and then the American AACS. You know, so it's they all came together in one little tiny place in Labrador.
Yeah, when you say a tiny place, how many people were there?
Oh, maybe 100.
Wow. So why was this an important strategic place to put a weather station?
Well, what's really interesting is that this is sort of one of the most exciting parts of the book, actually, is I don't know if anybody has seen Darkest Hour with Winston Churchill. And Winston Churchill goes into the loo at one point and calls Roosevelt up and says, oh, my God, Franklin, can't you help me? You know, we've got these guys at Dunkirk. We need your arms. We need your men. We need your weapons. And Roosevelt says, well, if you want, I can send you some planes, but they have to be flown from Los Angeles to the border, to the Canadian border, and then you have to pull them across the border with horses, and then you can fly them to Europe. And Churchill's just shaking his head, and we sort of think, in the movie, it's sort of laughed off. But in fact, 10,000 planes were flown over the North Atlantic for the first time in history, and those planes, which became the movement of those planes, which became known as the Ferry Command, is what won the war.
And that's kind of interesting to me because my father was in the Ferry Command, in the Air Transport Command in World War II. He was a navigator, and he flew planes from the United States to Gander, Newfoundland, where they would refuel, to the Azores, where they would refuel, to England or
Scotland, Northern Scotland.
Yeah, they flew to North Africa as well, that from South America. But
what they needed, what those pilots needed, and why Woody was there is they needed what's called highways in the sky. So they needed air-to-ground communication systems, both to, you know, radar systems, both to tell them what the weather is going to be like, and also to tell them, should they be flying lower? Should they be flying higher? Should they take the southern route, like as you're describing? Should they take the northern route? And they needed, I mean, weather was in World War II, the knowledge of weather was a strategic element.
And we need to remember that World War II happens about 15 years after Charles Lindbergh flies across the Atlantic for the first time solo.
Yes.
So the technology was a little bit different than it is today.
Well, when the first flight over in the Ferry Command in November of 1940, they flew at 18,000 feet and they sucked oxygen through a straw,
mm-hmm.
you know, so.
Well, introduce us to the characters of the book. Who was Renatus?
Well, Renatus was an amazing person. And in fact, some people lately, the more they hear the story, have suggested he may have been an Inuit shaman.
Hmm.
And they say that for a couple of reasons. First of all, as I'm first introduced to Renatus, Renatus is a man who made the sealskin kayak for Woody, that Woody kept for 65-odd years.
It's a beautiful and detailed model.
It is, and it's a classic northern Labrador. I mean, I don't know if there's like 200 different kinds of kayaks, and every group of Inuits have a different kayak, and so this is quite clearly from northern Labrador. I knew Renatus as the father of Harriet, the father of Woody's girlfriend, or his steady, and the young woman who Woody says kept him sane during the year that he spent in Labrador, that Harriet and her family really kept him sane.
And she would have been a teenager.
She would, yes. He was 21 or 22, and I think she was 17, you know, so he was a tall, older man. Anyway, I learned more about Renatus almost by accident, and it turns out he has played a very important role in Labrador and Newfoundland politics, cultural politics. He was one of the I'll start at the beginning. I found him featured in three books. He was and when you think about it, this is an Inuit man who was born in 1896, who ended up dying in 1950, who's completely lost from history. Until I start digging around, he's in a book by the famous archaeologist, a photo of him in the book by the famous archaeologist, Stephen King Hutton. He's in a book that was published by an RCMP officer in 1922. And he's most famously in a book called The Challenger, which was written by Admiral Stephen Ritchie about the 1933-1934 survey of Nain Labrador that the British Royal Admiralty was conducting. And Renatus, as it turns out, led a rebellion in Hebron against the Hudson's Bay Company. And they broke into the Hudson's Bay Company three times. Actually, they only broke in once. They made a key, and they used the key for the second and the third times. But it was a big struggle. It was the Depression. People were starving. The Hudson Bay Company refused to give credit. And Inuit are very much a sharing kind of culture. What's mine is yours. What's yours is mine. And this just didn't sit too well with the Hudson Bay Company, which was what's mine is mine until you pay for it. And so so they broke in and they stole $150 worth of goods.
It reminds us of the relationship Native Americans have with the government and the settlers who are moving into our part of the country.
Absolutely. And I could almost even say it reminds us of 100 years ago in the North Dakota, when you had the Minnesota grain interests and banking interests and railroad interests charging exorbitant rates to North Dakota farmers, and even the North Dakota Banking Association said these are usurious interest rates, and hence the Bank of North Dakota came into being.
I should mention here that you've written a book, The Bank of North Dakota, An Experiment in State Ownership, which was published in 1989, and several years before that you worked in the office of Congressman Mark Andrews.
Yes. Boy, I couldn't have given myself a better plug, could I?
So Renatus is well known in Labrador, at least.
He is now.
He is now. And he had a family. And it's kind of interesting, the Inuit family structure.
It's fascinating, the Inuit family structure. It was very much a communal family structure historically, where families, generations of families lived together, and even clans, you know, the Semiacs, the Tuglevinas. Renatus' last name is Tuglevina.
Mm-hmm.
Semiacs, Tuglevinas, Obeds, Jarus, they may all hunt together, fish together, camp together. And once the missionaries came, that was discouraged, and the people were discouraged from living in large sod houses. They wanted people to be an individual family houses. But Renatus is he has what one of the writers, Helge Ingstad, says he lived larger than most Inuit. He just lived larger.
He was famous among the Inuit.
He was famous among the Inuit. Yes, and I was actually lucky enough to meet two of his daughters who were still living, and their husbands, and a number of his grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
Well, Woody always wondered what happened to Harriot, and
yes,
you found out.
I did find out, and I must say I was in tears when I found out. And I, should I say? They were together. As he said, they didn't become boyfriend and girlfriend right away, but they were together, and I think he truly loved her, and I think she truly loved him. But he said when it came time to go, he had to leave. And that, you know, you don't say no. He tried to explain to
Harriet. He was in the Army.
He was in the Army. He had to leave. And he actually learned Inuktitut. She never spoke English. Renata spoke English. Harriet never spoke English. But Woody learned Inuktitut. And when it came time to go, he said, I took one look. But I wasn't a hunter. I wasn't a sealer. You know, what could I do? But he carried her with him his entire life, and he carried the memory of this story his entire life. And I think he was at the end of his life, and he really wanted to know what had happened. And luckily, the Moravian mission kept very detailed records on births, confirmations, marriages, and deaths. And she died at the birth of her fourth child, about 8 years after Woody left. And so this entire time, for his whole life, really for 60-odd years, he was wondering what had happened to her and had been looking online to see if he could find out. But she had died.
Hmm. What was the challenge of tracing the family history of an indigenous group in northern Labrador?
It was a terrific challenge because people were moved. The Canadian government moved them. The Moravians abandoned Hebron. The Inuit were moved south.
And that happened in 1959?
That was 1959. And so what's that, 40, 50 years?
Yeah.
But like North Dakota, if you went to North Dakota and you went to Grand Forks and you said, I'm looking for an Enerson, there would be somebody there who would say, well, maybe you should try up near Hamilton. There might be some up there. And that's what happened in Labrador. One of the difficulties is that people had so many of the same names. And so which Joseph Tuglavina, which Renatus Tuglavina am I looking for? But I had help along the way. And I think that's the most amazing thing to me about this story is I simply put one foot in front of the other, and I would say to myself, geez, I wonder where so-and-so is. For example, I just flew to Labrador. I booked a flight to Goose Bay, and then I booked a flight to Nain and a flight to Hopedale, because that's pretty much, if you're an Inuit, that's pretty much where you live in Labrador. And I got to Nain, and I asked the desk clerk at the small hotel I was staying in, and I said, I'm looking for Ernestina Tuglavina, which is Renatus's granddaughter. And she said, well, that shouldn't be a problem. Her daughter works here in the morning. So, you know, those sorts of things have just really been helpful to me.
So how were you met when you
I was welcomed.
To these people?
I was, you know, it was, I don't know if I can explain this, Douglas, but here I'm taken over to Ernestina's house on a snowmobile. The house was built in 1959. It was part of this awful structures built up to house these relocated Inuit. It's cold. The doors don't close. There's double blankets hanging over the window. It's you know that the person who lives there is doing their best to keep the head above water. That's what you know. And the struggle for wood. And yet Ernestina fed me tea. She fed me crackers. I had this brand new Apple laptop, and I was showing her pictures of her deceased husband and her grandfather and her aunts, and I'm in the middle of a very desperate situation, and we're both crying. It felt like I had been there. It felt like I had been there forever, you know?
Did she know anything about Woody?
No, she was too young. Mm-hmm. She was too young. Woody knew her husband, you see. Woody, her husband was Harriet's son. And Woody knew him as a baby. But he had passed away with cancer and alcoholism. So,
yet Woody kept thinking about Harriet for decades and decades. So yeah. I'm trying
He's
to
He's a bit of a stubborn Norwegian, Doug. I mean that.
Well, I'm just thinking about these seven servicemen in the middle of this very different place.
Yes.
And there probably is some novelty to having them there.
Yes.
And the Inuit girls were over at their place a lot, weren't they?
They were. And you know, the mothers were very happy to have the girls there. I mean, in some sense, it's just genetics. Diseases brought by white settlers, the fishermen going up and down the coast, devastated much of the Inuit population. Two-thirds of Hebron was destroyed in the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic. Massive Inuit died through tuberculosis and other diseases. And so here you have somebody coming in who is tall and strong and immune to these diseases. And, of course, the mothers want children, want grandchildren. And the mothers were very adamant that this was something that they would encourage and endorse and support. So.
And Harriet was quite young when she passed away, and that was not unusual.
It was not unusual. And, in fact, it's one of the things Woody said, that looking at the cemeteries, the mothers and the children die so young.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But, again, I'm getting to this Woody Belsheim thing.
Yes.
Because when you talk to him, obviously this meant a lot to him. He gave you the kayak.
He gave me the kayak, yes. It meant a lot to him. We all have our first love, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
We all have that person who sits
in our heart. And Harriet was his.
And Harriet was his. And they sit in our hearts. And it doesn't matter how many other people we may love afterwards, we still have our first love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just human emotion, human nature.
What was the most surprising discovery you made as you were researching this story?
I think going over to England, which was part of the story, to find out about Renatus being arrested by the British surveyor, and going over to read his diary about Renatus and seeing the high esteem that this British surveyor held Renatus in. And then discovering that he had 400 photographs of Labrador that had never been published or used in any other media. So it was the breadth, I think. It's the breadth that how could this Inuit man born in 1896 cover Canada, the United States, Great Britain? How could his presence cover those three countries? Well, Newfoundland was an independent country at that time, too. It wasn't part of Canada.
So it's kind of a life writ large. He's an important person.
Yeah.
Well, the book is Renatus's Kayak, and it's a Labrador Inuk, an American GI, and a secret World War II weather station. There are lots of stories intertwined here. It's an entertaining read. And Roseanne Innerson Junker, thank you for being our guest today.
Can I say that it's on Amazon.com,
should you
wish to?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Coming up next on Main Street, Dakota Date Book.
Hey, you might want to check the calendar because February 14th is right around the corner. You can help yourself by getting a head start on Prairie Public Short and Sweet Fun Drive. Or you could be singing...
It is a big day. Everybody has to remember, get your Valentine some chocolate, or you are going to be in the doghouse.
Take it from Nancy Olson, head pastry chef at Nicole's Fine Pastry in Fargo.
And I think with your membership drive, what a bargain of the century.
For a $10 a month contribution, you'll help fund the high-quality, commercial-free radio you enjoy so much and come to depend on, and Nicole's will send your sweet someone a box of decadent, sensuous chocolate truffles.
It's really good. It's Calibo chocolate. It's really high-end. It's nice and bittersweet, some great cocoa powder around it.
Go to prairiepublic.org, get your order in now, and check being a hit on Valentine's Day off your list.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 15th. James J. Hill is a big name in the railroading history of the Great Plains, earning his nickname the Empire Builder. In 1878, Hill teamed up with several other investors to purchase the financially ailing St. Paul and Pacific Railroad, which was renamed the Great Northern Railway. Hill spent two decades pushing the railroad across the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Ocean. He called the railroad the great adventure of his life. He was justifiably proud of it. He said, "When we are all dead and gone, the sun will still shine, the rain will fall, and this railroad will run as usual." On this date in 1907, the Bismarck Daily Tribune reported on a coal shortage in North Dakota. C.F. Larrabee, the acting commissioner of Indian Affairs, had received a telegram from Superintendent Charles Zeebach of the Fort Totten Indian School regarding a clogged railroad line. Zeebach pleaded with Larrabee to contact Hill and ask him to do whatever he could to get coal to the school. Zeebach said there was less than a week's worth of coal left, and the 3,000 students would be very cold if more fuel did not arrive quickly. In a letter to Governor John Johnson of Minnesota, Hill explained that the roadblock was caused by increased rail traffic and not enough track. He said another 75,000 miles should be built in the next 5 years. Hill acknowledged that this would be an enormous task. At 140 tons of iron per mile, it would require two-thirds of the country's annual steel production and place a demand on labor for grading the rail beds, laying the track, and building bridges. James S. Harlan, the Interstate Commerce Commissioner, contacted North Dakota Senator Henry Hansbrough with assurances that the Great Northern Railway was doing everything possible to ease the coal shortage. Hill reported that 5 trainloads had been sent out. He had instructed his superintendents to use coal from the company's locomotive supply to prevent actual suffering. Fortunately, the coal did arrive at Fort Totten before the last of their supply ran out. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Poet Kwame Alexander was just 10 years old when he realized that words can empower you.
We're facing off with police on horses in riot gear, and I'm crying, and all of a sudden, we start singing. We're fired up, we can't take no more. We're fired up, we can't take no more.
Poetry and protest. Plus the latest on the debate over immigration on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll hear from Paul Connors, the Canadian Consul General in Minneapolis. He spoke to the Chamber of Commerce in Bismarck last week. Connors also sat down with our news director, Dave Thompson, and they talked about the importance of NAFTA to Canada and to North Dakota. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.